From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1888 in Rochester. Workers began constructing a building that would come to be known as the Flatiron. At the time, University Avenue was a streetcar route. Different time then, of course, the building became a distinctive landmark. But over the years, this mixed-use building kind of deteriorated. Bats and pigeons took up residence in the upper levels. By 1981, the Flatiron was a candidate for demolition. But a man named Paul Kramer didn't want to see that happen. He saw history and potential and found a way to fund its renovation. And today, the Flatiron lives, largely thanks to Paul's efforts. He's a recipient of the 2015 Reshaping Rochester Award. We're going to talk to Paul in a moment. And this hour, we will explore more about the winners, the vision, and our city's future. My guests include Mo Duggan. Maureen Duggan is the executive director of the Community Design Center of Rochester. It's nice to have you here, Mo.
Thanks, Evan. Great to be here.
Paul Kramer's here. He's the winner of one of the Reshaping Rochester Awards, the Director's Award for his renovation of the Flatiron Building in Rochester's Neighborhood of the Arts. And Paul, we'll have a lot to talk about. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Mike Garvinale's here, recipient of the Reshaping Rochester Honorable Mention Award and a founder of Reconnect Rochester. Every time I think about the future of transportation that doesn't just involve the automobile, I think about Mike. How you doing?
Oh, that's nice to say, Evan. Always good to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's nice to have you here. I want to say to our listeners, too, we need this hour, everyone. We need an hour of talking about positivity, of talking about the future of our city in a way that is exciting. You know, have a nice conversation about what it means to reshape Rochester. It's been a heavy week. We had an important discussion last hour. I come out of the last hour. Everyone in the newsroom is buzzing with this sort of sickly feeling watching the cable news stations ransacking the apartment on live TV of the people behind the San Bernardino attacks. I want our listeners to know some people in the news media are equally appalled by this. You're not the only ones, and we wouldn't do it. Let's talk about something positive this hour. Let's talk about what it is the Reshaping Rochester Awards are. Been going on for 5 years, fifth year for this?
Yep, exactly. And we're just delighted. We get more nominations from the community every year. And I think that speaks to the fact that a lot of people are getting how important it is to care for our built environment and to be advocates for it. So we're just delighted to be the hosts of this award program, and that will be next Wednesday at Temple Berth Kodish.
I know a lot of our listeners are really engaged in the community,
yes.
And if you'd let them, they'd find a way to come out. Can they still attend on Wednesday?
They can.
Okay,
they
how
can.
Do they do that?
They can go out to our website, and our website is cdcrrochester.org.
And if you just Google Community Design Center,
it will come up. Yeah, and it will make it easy for you. You can definitely go through PayPal and buy your ticket. We would be delighted to have you.
So it's Wednesday, Temple Berth Kodish, you said?
That's right, and we get started right at 11:45.
Well, Paul Kramer, one of the winners of the award, the Flatiron Building is something that's so distinctive to us. Your first encounter, you remember your first encounter with the Flatiron?
Yeah, I had seen it, but my first encounter was when it was listed in 1981. And you talk about first encounter, okay. I went through it. I had done renovation over in Cornhill. I'd done a two-family and converted into two townhouses. And I'd refinanced it. I was looking for something else. I was actually considering going to Boston. I walked in the building, and I saw all the original molding still there. It hadn't been painted. Four working marble fireplaces were still there. And it had never been changed, renovated at all. 30 minutes later, I made an offer on it.
30 minutes later?
Yeah. I made an offer I knew the owners wouldn't take. It was a cash offer, which I didn't have, but...
So, you liked the building that much?
Yeah, well, I believed that it was something worth doing. It was, like I say, structurally, it was very sound, and it had a lot of the original, had all the original molding in it. Original huge winding staircase going up the center of the building, and the marble fireplaces and all the maple floors were still there. So it was quite salvageable. A lot of work, but you had to be able to see that. Yeah, it was just an instant thing for me to say, yeah, this should be done. And then the rest of his history about trying to get money and going forward with that.
Now, Paul, you know, some of the legend is that there were actually bats in the belfry there. Is that right?
Yeah, they occupied the upper floors. There were half the windows were missing when I bought the building. So we had to replace them all. There used to be a boat launch crane out the top in the middle of the building. It later became six apartments and two-story lofts. All the original sconces for the ballroom were there. There's two ballrooms in there, one on the second floor and one on the third and fourth floor. And the original wallpaper was still there. It was curled, but it was still there. I mean, a lot of
original wallpaper from when?
1888.
From 1888. Yeah. Wallpaper never dies. It does start to curl.
It curls, but it was silk. It was in excellent condition.
Oh, wow.
But
so you had this vision for it. You're one of those people. Paul is in the vein of my wife. We can walk into an empty house, and I do not have a vision for it, and she can see exactly what it's going to look like and has this amazing ability to sort of visualize, conceptualize, and go forward with it. But Paul, what did you really think at that time was the best use for this going forward? What did you, you know, tell me more about that vision.
For me, the biggest thing is to have living units that anyone would want to occupy. You don't do lower income, you don't do higher income, you do market what that is. At the same time, I realized, because I was in Cornhill, you can't gentrify the neighborhood. So in going forward with that...
Hold on, back it up. You said you can't gentrify the neighborhood.
You can't displace a lot of people. You have to keep them there and try to keep them there. I mean, it can't always be done. But so one of the other things involved in doing the building, I also bought 11 houses surrounding the building. And some of them were, you know, should have been torn down, actually. We renovated them, but the idea was I made it possible for the tenants that were there to keep the first floor, and then I'd take the second floor and loft it up and make a high-end unit. So you mixed demographics, financial and race and creed and everything else in one area, one building. You didn't displace. What's sort of an interesting, you have, you know, people go to East Side, West Side. In our neighborhood, the west side is the original people have been there 30, 40 years, all same demographic that's been there forever. And then the east, in the west side in this situation here, I'm seeing, maybe I said it wrong, the west side of this neighborhood is newer tenants. And, you know, that was one of the things we intent tried to keep that neighborhood intact. And it's true today, it's the same demographic.
But when you thought about the issue of gentrification, was that a pragmatic thing, that it hasn't worked well, or that was that more sort of an ethical choice to be sort of focused?
They said it wouldn't work well. It was one of the biggest problems they have with financing. I mean, people who were supposed to be community-oriented, I never got money in Rochester, New York to do that building. It came from all over the country, different places. You know, the financing wasn't available to do it. And that was, you know, the thought process is you can't do that. You can't keep the same tenancy. And I said, well, you have to. This is a new world. 30 years ago, I said, you know, we have to come to one world. We can't keep segregating people in financially or belief systems or anything else.
Can I just ask Mo what you think about hearing that? Because that's an issue that is ever present in community conversations about how to develop.
Well, I think that's why the board chose Paul this year, because, you know, we hear a lot about urban pioneers, right? But what Paul's done is he's stabilized a neighborhood. He hasn't even mentioned what he did with the open air drug market and whatever else. And it's hard for someone driving down that area now in the neighborhood of the arts to envision how challenged it really was and how many years it took. So When the board of the Community Design Center was looking for someone to give this award to, they looked at this body of work, and they said, this is somebody that's not only saved a building, but they've saved and stabilized the neighborhood. And from that, you know, Writers and Books was stabilized. Mm-hmm. And from that, the Neighborhood of the Arts and Art Walk developed. And there were many champions that worked with Paul on that.
Was that the first domino for all of those things happening?
From what my understanding is, it was very early days. Mm-hmm. There were some other things were going on, too. The very beginning of the Design Center, one of the very first things that the founders of the Design Center worked on is there was an idea that the city had about widening University Avenue. And at that point, the Design Center worked with the neighbors and said, no, wait a minute, let's talk about this. Is this something that is really good for the neighborhood, not just the commuters that were racing down University? And so that's really sort of where we cut our teeth as well. So there were a lot of different people involved, but Paul was one of the mainstays, the solid sort of the rock that a lot of this was built on.
And so, Paul, let me ask you sort of two prongs of that then. What did people around you say about kind of getting involved down there and looking at that building particularly?
It took a while. I mean, in 81, and I didn't get approvals until like 83, 84, and I started work 85. And people, first thing I did was that building was boarded up completely on the backside, and half the front side was boarded. And this was another thing, people said, what are you doing? I took all the plywood off and put glass the whole building and the neighborhood that people had gotten killed every once in a while. Anyway, and that statement was saying that, and we can do what we want here, this neighborhood will allow it. And then at the same time, I renovated the upper units and made them very high-end design pieces. Today, they're sort of catching up with those designs. A lot of people have copied them along the way. But, the main thing was to keep the neighborhood strong and keep people coming to it because it was inviting. You know, and that's the main thing that had to be for everybody, inviting for everybody.
So if you first encountered it in 81, when was the first time that you felt like a real neighborhood change had happened?
Well, around 86, 87, there were some people that, started to see that I was staying there, that I wasn't just short term, and we'd had conversations. And one of the main people was a gentleman named Doug Dempster, who was a professor at the University of Rochester. And at the same time, we were working, Writers and Books was considering leaving the neighborhood. And so he got on board, and he was really the impetus to form a group that was called the Steering Committee that formed the Neighborhood of the Arts. And basically, we looked at things that were advantages to the neighborhood, what were its assets. And, I said to them, I came here because that building lies between the Memorial Art Gallery and the Eastman House. And I said, the original partners we had involved, that's one of the reasons they considered it was possible to do. That and the fact that through the arts, you touch everyone. If someone listens to a good piece of music or they look at a great piece of art, somewhere they have to consider the artist who created it. And that's not, anyone that you might know. It could be totally from any facet of life. And some of the great art is. At the time they did it, they were not considered part of the norm. And then they became world famous. And their work is worth millions and millions of dollars. But at the time they did it, they were, honored.
A couple of comments here. Danielle just writes, this is not Paul's first award. The Arts Council gave him an award for his contributions to the community years ago. Brent just wanted to know, for those of us who aren't in Rochester often, what's in that building now? What's in the Flatiron now?
There's six stores. There's a coffee shop, which has been there for like 15 years now. My wife changed it into a... There used to be Moonbeams, which is sort of coffee, sort of wine bar. It was run by a woman who was really influential in the filming in Rochester, I'm trying to think, Goff, and I'm trying to remember. Before she'll kill me.
It's okay. She's probably not listening. It's okay.
Paul Nogoff, she's now Paul Noblock's wife, and that doesn't help me either. But anyway, it was a little place of gathering, and she had influence and brought every kind of person in there. Because she was connected with the entire community. And then she sold it to someone else, and it didn't work out too well. And then my wife and I were looking at it, and she wanted to do it. And I said, do you know what a restaurant means? You have to be there 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. And she finally persuaded me that it was okay for her to do it. But anyway, she did it and converted it into, a Starbucks-type thing, but with a higher quality menu. They serve nice wraps, all fresh food. A lot of it's baked right there. And then she sold it later to someone else who is now in there. There are two partnerships there. Aaron is one of them, and the other person is not there.
And then the upper levels there?
And then the upper levels, the upper levels were turned into high-end apartments. They were done first in order so that I could wait for the right tenant on the first floor. Then the other first floor tenants are Edibles. They've been there for 18 years. Edward Jones has only been there 10, and then there's two antique dealers. Both of them deal worldwide. They don't just deal here. They ship a lot all over the world. And then there's a hairdresser in the back who's been there for 15 years too.
So what's the, Paul, what's the lesson for other parts of our city? You know, you go back to 1981, there was a lot of uncertainty. And as you say, it was maybe half a dozen years before the neighbors around you realized that you weren't going to be one of these quick hitters, you know, in, out, that you were there for the long haul. And it took some time. And now you look at the Neighborhood of the Arts, and there's a lot of pride, and certainly you're viewed with this great respect for the work that you've done there. What's the lesson for really anyone, whether it's Rochester, New York, or Geneva, or pick any town or city, about revitalization? What have you learned there?
You have to win the long haul. You can't be in there. I mean, part of the biggest problem with development is you're up against financial restrictions that banks, you know, often make you refinance in 10 years, which means you can't commit. How can you commit to 30 years if you know? And luckily, in the end, I finally did get long-term financing from somebody in the southern tier. But that's the one is obtaining financing that will make it happen. You know, you have to be, if you can do a long-term commitment, you have to have financing that allows you to do a long-term commitment. The other thing is you have to engage the neighbors that are there. You have to see what makes them tick, how things work, and allow other things. I mean, one of the things like widening the street that Mo talked about, when it was said, and one of the original director of her, no, punk in. I'm having a bad day remembering these things.
The design center. Yes.
Yeah. They were involved in it, and they curb. It was Citizens for Redevelopment of University Avenue, is what it was called. And it was a group that got together. And we all said, well, widening isn't really the right move, because that just makes it a highway that people speed through, and they don't go through the neighborhood. So we worked with the city, and then Doug Rice, who had moved into the neighborhood, came along, and he's went to get this T111 grant, I believe it was called, from the state, and that it's environmental enhancements to the street, or enhancement street, not just environmental. And that was, you know, at the first time around, I think it was $80,000. So the city didn't have to come up with all the money to do what we wanted. And the enhancements were, they have to do stabilization to the neighborhoods, and they have to make it more viable to live there. So in that, we have put curb cuts in. When I say curb cuts, the bump outs that come along, and it makes people slow down, which is extremely crucial, because it took the speed limit from 50 down to 35. And that was a huge fight for us. And the city said, no, you can't do that. And we actually put cars out there at the places we wanted bump outs, so that the engineers could see that it didn't impact the travel of the cars coming in from the suburbs. And it also makes it feel when you have a street that's done to, the distance for them to actually go across now becomes 18 feet instead of 45. So the distance they have to feel that they're in the traffic is much less. So that was a huge thing, and it was a huge change for how traffic engineers thought.
Mm-hmm. So, Mo, what do you see as some of the lessons? I mean, there's no perfect formula for, right, you know, improving a neighborhood, but my affection for that neighborhood is not just the arts component of it that Paul talked about, which I think is great. The fact that over the decades it's been done with an eye on how do we do this and keep people feeling included and not pushed out?
Yep.
You know, what are some of the lessons you see there?
Well, that's a big part of it. And that's why I think, you know, we talked about demographics and gentrification. And the lesson I think that we can take from that area is that it's possible to do that kind of grassroots, ground up work in other neighborhoods, too. And I think that those lessons can be applied throughout our city and throughout our region. It takes those champions, and it takes involving the neighbors, which is something that we really believe in at the Design Center. It's got to come from the neighborhood. When we do these charrettes, we learn so much. You go in with your preconceived notions of what a neighbor should want, and they tell you, no, this is what we need. This is what we really want. And listening to the people that live there is invaluable. There's nothing like it.
2015 Community Design Center Rochester Reshaping Rochester Awards are next Wednesday, and Paul Kramer's on the list there. Does it have a special meaning for you?
Yeah, well, two things. My screen came up. It's Johnny Monroe. I mean, how could I forget? She helped
us. Of course.
Who was the original director. And then the other one, Christine Goff. And a lot of people know that. And she's now Christine Knobloch. But they were both, Johnny was in the design center end of it. But Christine also brought a lot of people there because of her connections in the city of Rochester. She helped a lot to make it say, well, this is viable. I'm here. And she was, you know, like I say, she was the main makeup person for almost all the filming shot in Rochester, so she knew a lot of people.
let me grab a phone call. Carlene wants to weigh in Rochester. In Rochester, this is Carlene. Go ahead.
I think having known him for so many years, you can never listen to the city, because if the city had their way, they would have plowed everything down. And when he says no money was available, there were no visionaries anywhere. I think he had to go to New York City and God knows, maybe Timbuktu, but back in the day, we were all living, young artists and teachers and whatever, were living in the area and in Park Avenue, but nobody had a lot of money. But when you take someone like Paul, who has the vision and will stick with it, regardless if the city has no vision whatsoever, it's quite wonderful. Because, you know, we opened our first antique shop in 77 on Park, and along came everybody else, all the other artists, everyone was there. But to do a project of the visionary level of what Paul has created, when the politicians have absolutely clueless about what you're doing, is very sad. I mean, people will compliment it now, but I can't speak more highly of his determination. And not unlike Larry Glazer. So thank you for letting me compliment him.
All right, Charlene. Yeah, thank you for the phone call. That's very nice to hear, isn't it?
Nice. How nice.
Give me tears.
Well deserved.
Yeah, I'm not going to weigh in on whether politicians tend to have vision, but sometimes it does take a really big, you know, big mind for development and vision. And that's why Paul is on this list now. If you want to call the program and talk reshaping and redevelopment, that's what we're talking about this hour, Reshaping Rochester 2015 Awards. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're right here in Rochester, 263-9994. I'm happy to jump on and grab more of the comments we see on Twitter and your phone calls in just a second. I see the phones ringing. And if you're just joining us, Mo Duggan is here. Maureen is the executive director of the Community Design Center Rochester. Paul Kramer, one of the winners of the Reshaping Rochester Awards in 2015. Mike Governale is here, recipient of the Reshaping Rochester Honorable Mention Award and the founder of Reconnect Rochester. And here is a comment from a listener named Jake. And so, Mike, I'm going to kick this one your way here. Jake says, I can't see anything but good things coming from the partial inner loop closure and redevelopment. Were there any other well-developed plans left on the table to close more of it if money becomes available 5 years from now? Jake, I can tell you, and I'll get Mike's take on how walkable or the impact of what's going on with the inner loop. But to Jake's question on are there plans left on the table, and maybe Mo can jump in too. Every time I've talked to Jim McIntosh or city engineers or people involved with that project, they always tell me two things. They say, number one, it's not the closure of the inner loop. It's closure of one third of the inner loop. But number two, logically, it's not a definite, but it certainly feels like a logical extension would be future closure of the rest of the other two thirds. So, I mean, Mo, what have you heard?
Well, you know, I wouldn't comment on that other than to say that I'm going to actually say two things. One is that I think you're absolutely right. I think people will be looking at this at the inner loop, and they'll be looking at the success, and I think it will be a success, and then that will make it easier to fund the next piece and the next piece. We see Syracuse looking at it when they look at Route 81 and its impact on their downtown. And I want to go back to something that Carlene said earlier, and Carlene, thank you so much for calling in and recognizing Paul's visionary impacts. You know, I'm seeing a change when we talk to our public officials. We're seeing the growth of bike lanes and bump outs and things like that. I think people are getting it, and I'll leave it to Mike, who really follows this much more closely. But now it's what is the next step? What can we do to make it even more walkable and more safe and more pedestrian friendly?
Mike, what do you think?
I think those are great comments, and I applaud that caller. You don't know how good it is to hear somebody acknowledge the positives that are will come out of the inner loop reconstruction project. Often I hear a lot of negativity. You know, why are they doing this? Why are they getting rid of the inner loop? I use it every day. But really, you have to understand the project. Just take a look at the plans that are on the city's website and the renderings, and you'll understand that we're not removing, like you said, Evan, we're not removing the inner loop. We're actually turning it back into a neighborhood street, a boulevard, where you can have multiple modes of transportation use it, people walking on it, biking on it, and bringing development, you know, good urban development back into that area. The city's opening up something like 8 acres mm-hmm. of new acres of developable land. So I'm really excited to see what that turns into. You know, right now we had a 12-lane highway when you consider the service roads on either side of it too. So it just wasn't being used. And I know the city is considering, you know, looking at the northern end of the inner loop too. I think after this reconstruction, this portion of the project is done, I think we'll see a reduction in the amount of traffic on that northern spur. And then, you know, who knows, in the future, that the northern side might get looked at too. You know, I know the way the construction, the roads are set up now with the construction going on, I'm definitely noticing a lot less traffic there. And I don't see any congestion or anything like that. So all signs are looking good if you're looking to see the entire inner loop get filled in one day, knock on wood. And I know I'm going to take a lot of heat from that, probably from the next caller. But
well, Mike, what do you want to see those 8 acres become?
Oh, I would like to see a good variety. Pretty much, you know, Paul took a lot of the thoughts right out of my head. A good mix of uses, residential, shops. It'd be great to see some family activities. I don't want to see a large-scale development go in there all at once. I'd like to see some organic growth. You know, break it up into smaller parcels and see what kind of a neighborhood can spring up there. I know Strong Museum is holding some community meetings, looking at, you know, what might be developed on that parcel of land right near the Museum of Play. I think there's some great ideas on the table, and I'm just really looking forward to seeing what the community has to say about it.
Listeners, if you want to weigh in on the inner loop, that's always sort of a powder keg, but you can feel free to do that. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Mike, I'll never forget about a year ago when we were talking about things really kind of getting going with this filling one-third of the inner loop, and someone said to me, I can't believe they're doing this. I love the inner loop. And I said, why do you love it? And they said, I love driving on it because no one's ever on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, maybe you're answering why the city wanted to do it. Or really, it's multi-pronged why the city wanted to do it. They'll tell you for a number of reasons. Dividing neighborhoods, less walkability. Mm-hmm. But they also will tell you, the statistics just show that the use doesn't really justify to begin with. If it was just even statistical car usage on a daily basis, it's not very high. So, but that's the story with the inner loop, and it will be very interesting to see what happens going forward there. I'm going to sneak in one more caller because I know Danielle wants to have a comment about Paul Kramer. Go ahead, Danielle.
Okay. Are you there?
We're here. And
okay,
and so
great.
Are you.
Thank you. I just wanted to let you know that Paul has done some amazing things in the neighborhood besides just the Flatiron Building. And if you look at the building in between Writers and Books and the Flatiron Building, some of you may remember that it was a police station.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 1977, I moved my studio onto Elton Street, and it was a scary neighborhood. The police checked in on me a lot, and then I really needed, for one reason or another, many years later, in 1985, to move out. And all I can tell you is Paul has done this awesome job on Imagine Square, and I just think you should know about it because there are also great community organizations from Baobab, Image City, My Place Connections, and the result of it is that we all, I think, I know Baobab and I know for myself, have developed international reputations, and we bring money from other parts of the country and from other parts of the world into the neighborhood. So really what Paul has done is not only raise the level of the neighborhood and make it wonderful without the usual form of gentrification, but he's made it accessible so that we who have businesses can feel good about having our customers who come from all over the world and other parts of the country be there. So I think there's something really special there. The other piece of it, though, is my understanding is, and I don't know much about the city, is I don't think the city is doing enough to help people like Paul. I know that Paul, to use the woman who's on your panel's statement about him being a visionary, is absolutely true. And he has visions for other sections of the neighborhood right nearby, things that you own, Paul, I know, because you've been a great landlord, and we talk sometimes, but they're not helping him. So I want to know how I, as a citizen, can get the city to listen to me to tell them to help Paul.
Thank you, Danielle. Paul, what do you think?
Yeah, Danny's been a real strong person. She came in, she has a dance studio, and as she says, she's international, and she travels to and does work all over the world, you know, Greece and in California and down in South America. And the other tenants that she's talking about, Baobab, they're an African culture center, and the person who runs that is now overseas over in Africa trying to get funding for people over there to get started. Mocha is his name. Anyway, there was also a choice. I mean, it was rentable to a lot of people, but when Mocha came to me, we worked something out so that they could stay there. And then the photography studio that's in there is the longest lasting studio apparently in New York State, continuous. And they bring people from all over the world too.
But have you not felt supported as she's kind of indicated?
What she said is, the city has done, I have, say not support. I was supported, and they, you know, thought that some of the ideas might be good, but they were a little bit, I was way beyond what they were thinking at the time. And the city has supported me in many ways. I'm not saying they didn't. Danny has, you know, but she knows other things I want to do. And I don't know so much as the city is, there's not money out there to do what I want to do, because it's a long risk for a financial institution to do. You know, I'm talking about visions ahead of making condominiums in that area. But again, right, there it goes back to another thing that I've been working on. The tax structure's wrong. I mean, it's this thing. One of the biggest things, I'm going to get my head in trouble here now. the thing that's being built by the George Eastman House, the housing's there, you know, it's more apartments. We don't need more apartments. We need more condominiums. We need more people living here. And the biggest roadblock to that is tax structure. I mean, when people, you know, it's more intelligent for the developer to make it apartments because the tax structure keeps it so they can run it. But if you made it so it's more intelligent to be owned, you'd have condominiums spring up real fast. And that's the biggest one, is the tax structure is based on improvement, not on what they call land value tax, where after someone does the development right, if they would do something in the Eastman lot there, that would make it possible for someone to come and buy a unit, and their taxes were, you know, a $200,000 unit, and their taxes were only $4,000 instead of $8,000 or $9,000. The city would be repopulated tomorrow, next year. And it can happen that fast because it would be a tax charge. No vacant parking lots downtown. This would be a building wouldn't have any vacants because you'd build, it would be economically intelligent to build on the land with a set tax rate as you go in. And it could change everything.
You're allowed to have opinions, and you're allowed to share them. Okay. You're speaking for yourself. That's okay.
Well, yeah, and Danny has been wonderful. She has. It's a wonderful dance studio, and yeah, I can't say enough about her and the other tenants in there. And there's a small, and that's the other thing. There's a small bakery, and it's just a couple. And anyone that's been there, it's called Goodness Cakes. And the thing about that, you know, it is no, you know, additives, no. I mean, you can taste. If you have a almond, blueberry, like, tart from them, or tort, or whatever way you want to say it, you will taste every item in it. It's not mushed in. It's beautifully done work.
Are they paying you for this?
No, I go there quite often and have it because it's...
Right, Paul's getting paid in cakes.
They're getting paid in cakes, yes.
There's no quid pro cake. And I am late for a break here. Todd on Twitter does want to push back on the Interloop. He says, of course, there is less traffic on the Interloop. A third of it's been removed. They took away the destination to which they go. And I know Todd's feeling is reflected by a good number of people who are going to miss the Interloop as well, but I do think it's eventually fully on its way out. Let's get a short break in, come back with more phone calls. Tim's on the phone. We'll get to Tim coming up here, and we're going to talk more about why Mike Governale is a recipient of Reshaping Rochester Award. The awards are next Wednesday. Mo Duggan next Wednesday at
We are going to be at 11:45 at Temple Berth Kodesh on Elmwood Ave.
On Elmwood Ave, and you can attend?
You can. Yes, you can still buy tickets on our website.
All right, the Community Design Center of Rochester's website, and that is next Wednesday for the awards. So let's get a short break in and come back with more discussion on reshaping Rochester next. I'm Evan Dawson, Monday on The Next Connections. New resources to serve the LGBTQ community. In our area, we'll sit down with members from the local Gay Alliance and talk about the new center. Find out what it's all about. Then second hour, it's the annual presentation of Hanukkah Lights. Join us 2 hours on Monday on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Studio Sales Pottery Gallery in Avon, offering holiday gifts created by local ceramic artists. Gallery hours and directions online at studiosalespottery.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tim in Pittsford, go ahead.
Hey, Evan. I usually call up and complain about the parking down there, but I do love it down there. My wife and I lived in the Park Ave area for years. When you rent an apartment there, you sign a lease for a year, and 6 months later, you're always looking for the next cool place to live, which is what we did. And we finally, and we were in our later 20s, looked at a place off East Ave on Upton Park, and which was foreign to us, even though we lived about maybe 1,000 yards away to the south. We liked it because it was quiet up there, but we had always hung out in East Ave and Park Ave area, and we had never really been up the university area, and we love that we could walk to Edibles and Starry Nights and all those places. So I have really nothing to complain about this time, which I know is a big letdown, but I'll throw one thing in there. If you could just somehow manage to put a small K-12 school connected to that building right on university, I swear we would have still been there today, but maybe my kids can enjoy that someday. So just another vision, just connected to that little V right there would have been great.
Thank you, Tim.
Neat. Such a cool thing. You know, you think about people in a community, and it's so wonderful to see children playing in a community. It's so important. It's a really neat comment. Thanks, Tim.
Well, we're talking to Mo Duggan, who's the executive director of the Community Design Center of Rochester, and the 2015 awards are next week. We've been talking to Paul Kramer, who's the winner of their director's award for his renovation of the Flatiron Building in the Neighborhood of the Arts, going back to 1981, when this 1888 building was dilapidated and looked like it was heading for a Nowheresville future. And Paul stepped in, stabilized it, and has had a big impact on that neighborhood. How many Flatirons are there in this country, by the way? I mean, we see...
There's a couple in this city.
Mm-hmm. Couple in this city, and...
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm sure...
They're so iconic.
Yeah.
Your mind's eye, you can probably see the one in Manhattan, the one in Toronto, right?
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
And that's, there's just something so remarkable
about
that.
There's a couple
them.
In San Francisco, too.
Yeah, it's very cool stuff. So even if you don't live in Rochester, you've probably seen it and are familiar with that. And Mike Governale is here, who is the recipient of the Reshaping Rochester Honorable Mention Award. He's the founder of Reconnect Rochester. And Mo, why Mike this year?
Well, you know, the board has a lot of latitude here, and they look at a body of work, Evan. They look at someone who has really contributed over the long haul in a unique way that has changed the built environment. And what's so compelling for us, particularly this year, is, you know, with me coming on board and Johnny retiring, is, you know, how wonderful to have someone like Paul, who's an urban pioneer and a visionary, and then this next generation of visionary and pioneer that's really looking at how we move people and vehicles and asking us to reimagine a more equitable distribution of that. And so that's really what is sort of powerful about our lineup this year. And I do want to mention that we also have two juried awards, Evan. We have the Betty Strassenberg Award for Activism. We also have the Robert Macon Award for Urban Innovation. So actually, on Wednesday, we will be giving out sort of, those would be surprise, the big reveal, if you will, who the winners and honorable mentions are there. So we look across the landscape and try to look at very, very unique and important bodies of work. But in the case of Paul and Mike, these are ones that the board sat down together and said, there's something that we want to honor here.
Okay. Mike, what's that like for you?
It's incredibly humbling. I can't even begin to tell you. It really is an honor to be recognized by the Design Center, especially, I've worked with the Design Center for at least the past 5 years now. We've had a really good partner in you guys. And when Reconnect Rochester was just an idea, just a couple of people brainstorming around a table at a bar, the Design Center invited us in to use their space and tap into their brain trust. And we've been collaborating with them on various projects, from the train station to the inner loop to various street projects. And it really has been beneficial to us as citizens of Rochester to have such a great resource that we can tap into. And I credit, a lot of credit goes to them for the development of Reconnect Rochester as an organization, too. So I thank you guys.
Thanks, Mike.
You know, we're Tim, who just called, is going to call back, and he always gives me grief when we talk too much about the future of post cars or post automobile addiction. And as a suburbanite now, he I know he feels a little bit of occasionally some stress about this idea that the conversations we have in this program about a multimodal future sometimes talk about, there it is, there's the phone ringing, it's probably Tim, it's probably not Tim, about this idea that suburbanites, and I'm one of them, drive into a city and assume that you can always park right in front of where you're going, walk right in, get right back in your car and come out. And Mike, especially in the last 5 years, what have you seen change, if anything, when it comes to the mentality that you're feeling and the future that you're seeing start to unfold there?
I've seen a lot of change just over the past couple of years, and I think as people start to see our roads being redesigned and bike lanes being added and, more people walking and biking, that sort of has a momentum to it. And as more people start doing it, more people start feeling safer about riding their bike and walking and using public transit. And, I think it'll have a snowball effect. I live in the suburbs, too. A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people think that I live in the city because I've been, sort of a cheerleader for the city and for urbanism. But I see the development of our city and systems like our public transit system as a selling point for a region, not just one neighborhood or the city of Rochester, but being in Irondequoit or Penfield or Henrietta. I think if you can get around the entire region from your house in the suburbs to your job in the city or wherever it is without the expense of having to maintain one or two vehicles, that's a huge selling point.
No?
There's also something, to think about as far as equity is concerned. A lot of us that, own a car, we have to make that choice. Well, geez, maybe I could ride my bike. Maybe I could walk. Maybe I should drive. Or maybe where will I park? There are areas, there are neighborhoods in our city where folks don't own cars. There's a huge proportion of the population in some of our neighborhoods where they don't have that option. So Mike's work and the work of Reconnect is beneficial to those neighborhoods, too. If you talk about somebody that's making $30,000 a year or less, if they don't need to have access to a car, their limited income goes further and can make their lives better.
Yeah, here in Rochester, I think we spend over a third of our income. I think it's like 30 or 31% of our income on transportation. And it's because of the way we've set up this system.
Right.
But I also, something Paul said earlier really resonated with me too, about when you have a good mix of people sharing a public space or living in an apartment building, I think that makes us all a little more aware and open-minded and really has an uplifting effect on a neighborhood and a city. And for me, public transit and just this, our streets in general are sort of like the great equalizer. They're the great community space. And I use various modes of transit. I drive, and I also bike, and I also ride the bus whenever I can. I wish I had a bus. and when I'm using public transit, I feel like I'm part of a community. And I I have witnessed, you know, people ask, you know, hey, where is Ed today? He didn't get on the bus. Even though we don't all necessarily know each other, you know, we sort of look out for each other. You're sharing this experience with, you know, 15 or 25 other people. And I think that has a really strengthening effect on a community.
Let me grab a phone call. And this is Carol in Rochester. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to tell you what my daughter, a project of my daughter, she is walking every neighborhood street in Rochester. She's just about completed. It's taken her about 3 years. And she had read about this in about a woman who had done this in Minneapolis. And, you know, it. And I've walked with her on a number of occasions, and she lives in the city. But it really kind of destigmatizes the city in the sense that you're there, you're walking, you're talking to people, you're petting people's dogs. She's taken pictures of incredible, you know, vernacular gardens. And it's just been sort of, our whole family now is kind of doing it on the weekends. She teaches during the week, but on the weekends when she's able to walk, you know, she usually tries to grab one of her siblings or me. And or her dad, and we're just really enjoying it.
Sounds like something for street films too.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, and you know that's something that we like to hear. Mm-hmm. And you know, not only in the city, but our suburbs are starting to do some really great things. You know, focusing on how can we retrofit some of our drivable suburbs to be more walkable and mm-hmm. bikeable. And Irondequoit and Henrietta are both doing active transportation plans. Pittsford is jumping in. Mm-hmm. So I see some really positive things on the horizon connecting all of our communities together this way.
Stephen on Twitter says the DNC mentioned the raising of the Terrence building today for the hotels and apartments. And I've always liked the look of Terrence. Can it be saved? I'm not as familiar.
Well, I'm looking to Paul, but I've done one blog post on the Terrence building. It was sort of an urban explorer's post, so I did a little bit of research on it. It seemed to me like there is a lot of asbestos and lead and other toxic stuff in that building. So
this is the former Psych Center on Elmwood?
That's right, yeah, and it's a huge building. So, you know, I don't have the money to redo the building myself, so I'm hesitant to.
No, I believe he's right. There's a lot of environmental problems. Mm-hmm. And is it cost effective? You know, that's one of the, do you say that? Because you have a major structure there. And what mm-hmm. does it cost to take it down? And what mm-hmm. does it cost to put a new one up to that mm-hmm. size? So that's always the, you know, in Europe, they never take anything down. They try mm-hmm. and save it. Mm-hmm. And maybe we should even look at it. Maybe we don't take that down because the outside structure is certainly will withstand it. And the time it was built, I'm sure that it's probably built better than most things that go up today. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether it's even financially feasible to do, but that's probably the biggest, what he said about the environmental things is probably the biggest roadblock in doing that.
Paul, I see a lot of overlap between the mentality behind the Community Design Center of Rochester, the Landmark Society, these groups that are interested in development sometimes by preservation or honoring historic sites. And you just mentioned that Europe doesn't, they don't seem to take anything down. They find a way to sort of retrofit.
They try to, yes. That's been, but you also, I mean, they, you know, the highway, we have a country where the highway could be built. So it was built. That was one of the things back in the 50s, you know, make the connection, build the highways. But also, your cities were older. They're much older, so they already had walking paths or cart paths set up. So to keep a city more community-oriented, it lasted longer because it made it more community-oriented. They already had these tractions of small roads and small little back alleys that people, you know, I forget the woman's name now, but she wrote a book about New York, about Rise and Fall of Great American Cities.
Jane.
And that's one of the things she says in there.
The book again is
The Fall and Rise of Great American Cities.
I think
cities.
It's the Life and Death of the Great
yes,
American
Cities. Yes, I apologize.
But what's terrible?
The
can't
author
the name?
Certainly is Jane Jacobs.
Jane Jacobs. And she said how important. Matter of fact, she said one of the biggest, because Harlem was one of the things that, you know, they built these beautiful townhouses when they originally built. And they thought they would all just be occupied. And the biggest thing she says is you have to have the cross-hatching of roads. If you were in Harlem, and I've been there, matter of fact, there's a, my son lives above there around Tryon Park and the Cloisters, and that's above, right above Harlem.
Right.
Anyway, the thing she's made the statement is you have to have the cross-hatching of roads. You can only have it, a block can only be so many feet long or so many meters or whatever you want to say. Mm-hmm. And in Harlem, they aren't. They, mm-hmm. The blocks are super, yeah. super long, yeah. which doesn't allow for someone to change direction and go to little shops other places. And that's really, she says, and I, from what I've seen, I tend to agree with her. That's the biggest problem with it. They'd have to mm-hmm. cut it open and put the back alleys in because you need them.
Mm-hmm.
Her book is, if anyone's never read it, mm-hmm. Jane Jacobs, yeah. incredibly good information in there, and the most astounding thing was written 60, 70 years ago.
Yeah.
All right, well, our listeners are always in the market for good books. Mike Governale, I'm going to give you the last word as an award recipient here. Ideally, 10 years from now, what's different in downtown or around our community that is realistic, 10 years?
I think it's very realistic to have more development up to the street, filling in some of these voids, especially downtown where we have so much surface parking. I like Paul's land value tax idea. Sure, let's
overnight,
try it.
5 years.
And also tying together hubs of activity and employment with more frequent, higher efficiency public transportation, such as bus rapid transit or light rail or streetcar circulator, so that we can start to move people around downtown in between Eastman Business Park, College Town, and downtown University of Rochester.
Next Wednesday at Temple Beth Kodesh, starting at 11:45 in the morning, it's the 2015 Reshaping Rochester Awards. And if you go on the website for the Community Design Center of Rochester, you can find tickets there still available, honoring people like Paul Kramer and Mike Governale, and also with some surprise winners as they reveal the rest of their awards as well. And Mo Duggan, have a great day next Wednesday.
Thank you.
Thanks for helping us end the week on a really sort of optimistic, positive note, looking at our community and honoring the people doing good things here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, and thank you, Mike Governale. Paul Kramer, congrats on all the great work and the award as well.
Thank you.
And thanks for the conversation. John Andrus, the engineer extraordinaire this hour. Thank you, John. And listeners, thank you for a really diverse and kind of an up and down week, but we're doing it together. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is member-supported public radio.